In the news.
Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government. I'm Eric McDaniel.
And I'm Jim Henson.
All right, so we're back for another week. And so again, we're gonna start off with primaries. So we had a bunch of primaries in the Northeast, which went kind of as we expected. Hillary Clinton did very well, only losing Rhode Island. And then, you know, Donald Trump has had his clean sweep. But if we look at this, we see Hillary Clinton did extremely well in the Northeast.
Yeah, very well. And it really puts the lie to one of the Sanders claims. The lie is too strong a word. But, you know, the Sanders campaign for a long time has been saying, Hillary Clinton, yeah, she's racking up all these delegates, but that's because she won big in the South. Now, as it turns out, she's actually doing pretty well in the North. They were trying to discount New York, it's her home state, et cetera, et cetera. But now the writing's really on the wall. There was sort of some degree of anticipation that Sanders might reconsider and reassess what was going to happen in the campaign. We may still see that. But the Sanders campaign seemed to backtrack on that a little bit last night. But overall, structurally looking at this, it's hard to look at this and not just conclude this is really a done deal as far as Hillary Clinton is concerned, particularly when you add in the superdelegates. She's very close. On the Republican side, then if you look at Trump also swept very convincingly by large margins. Kasich still hasn't been able to win a state. And, you know, a lot of people are suggesting, look, if Kasich can't win in Connecticut, where can he win? So where are we now? If we look at the Republican and Democratic delegate count, Trump well ahead, Hillary Clinton well ahead. I think we're still going to see a lot of maneuvering on the Cruz and Kasich side and on the Republican side as they try to deny Trump a majority. But he's actually overperforming slightly from where he was a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing about John Kasich is that he's still trailing Marco Rubio, who has not been in the race for several months. So that's not really good. But I guess Kasich is still going out looking for the contested election with the idea that if there's a contested election, contested convention, that, you know, people really hate Trump, people really hate Cruz. Hey, you know, so it's, you know, I'm not the one you wanted to take to the prom, but I'm not the worst. So I guess he's playing the what is it? I guess it's. I don't know.
My wife calls it when you see a bunch of guys hanging around, you know, at a party or at a bar late. You know, it's the last man standing strategy maybe the electorate will just, the Republican convention will just be so desperate that they'll just take the last guy that's awake at the party, you know.
Hey,
I don't know.
I guess he's hoping that the Republican convention will have beer goggles.
Exactly. Now, in terms of the way that we saw things unfolding during the week, we did see an interesting thing evolved between Kasich and Cruz earlier this week. And it became more interesting to me in terms of how the media covered it and the speed in which this thing became a huge story and then went away. And the story here is that Kasich and Cruz campaigns announced that they were going to essentially divvy up three of the bigger contests or the major contests that are coming up after yesterday's primary. So Kasich announced that he would abandon campaigning anyway in Indiana. The Cruz campaign said that they would not be campaigning in Oregon and New Mexico, the idea being that you would be able to cut the contest for the delegates to two major candidates. But as we saw in the coverage, and it happened very quickly, the initial announcement is along the lines of this headline, Cruz Kasich cut deal to undermine Trump's nomination. And it was like a news, you know, CNN was sending out news blasts, as were all the major outlets. It was this big deal that there was this maneuver going on. But really, within the day, first the press goes south on it, and people look and think about this and determine, A, not such a great deal for Kasich, and it really just reflects their comparative advantage and the fact that the Kasich campaign has no money. And then second, they look at the thing and say, overall, it's really just kind of stupid. So you get campaigns on the same day, like in the New Yorker, Cruz and Kasich's sorry plan to stop Trump. And then by the end of the day, Kasich is being captured on camera saying, hey, look, people in Indiana should still vote for me. It just means my campaign doesn't have any money and I'm not going to campaign there. That's all we're really saying. And so the whole thing goes from major strategic move to essentially BS by the end of the day. And it's really illustrates how rapidly the news cycle works and how much the inside political press is hanging on these insider process strategy stories. And it's really not very helpful when you come right down to it.
Yeah, I mean, when I first heard the story, I kept thinking, this sounds so unbelievably stupid. And it sounds like something you would see happening in you know, amongst teenagers, you know, where you call up Becky and you say, Becky, you know, I just can't stand Charlene. And then Becky starts bad-mouthing Charlene. Then you find out Charlene's there on three-way. You know, I'm surprised they didn't do that. I mean, I think that what's going to happen is the three of them are going to make a pact, show up in bangs for the next debate, and Trump shows up in bangs they won't have there. So Trump looks crazy. I don't know what else they're going to do. It comes off like Mean Girls in many ways. So it just made no sense. Like, look, I can't beat him. You can't beat him. But let's team up to beat him. Then we'll fight each other. But in the end, you know, it didn't look good for Kasich because it's like basically all you're doing is helping the bigger bully. Not calling Cruz a bully, but the idea is you're helping the bigger person there. So I thought it was really weak, and then it unraveled so quick. It was I think by 8 o'clock everybody was on it, and by 3 p.m. people were like, this is dead. Yeah. But
I mean, part of it is the speed with which like, the political press wants to break these things on Twitter and on the internet. It's like, you want to be the first to report it, so you report it as a big story before you've actually really thought about it very much. And then the next headline becomes, so you have the headline that it happened, and then the headline that it's stupid, and then the headline that it actually isn't happening very much. It's pretty pathetic.
You're basically seeing the press think. The thought process, which is problematic. Sometimes we don't want to see how the sausage is made. Sometimes we want the actual clear answer.
Okay, not to be like the press, but to flag something else that probably got buried a little in the presidential race last night. There was, on the Democratic side, an interesting primary in Maryland for an open Senate seat that's been created by the retirement of Barbara Mikulski, longtime Democratic senator in Maryland. She's retiring. There was a race between Chris Van Hollen and Donna Edwards, two incumbent members of Congress. Van Hollen, kind of part of the leadership team, part of, not to overuse a word that's been abused a lot this cycle, basically part of the Democratic leadership and sort of part of the establishment in the party, white male, longtime Democratic congressman from Maryland. And Donna Edwards, African-American, not quite as much tenure, more, you know, seen more from the left or progressive wing of the party. And Van Hollen beats Donna Edwards very, very convincingly, 53-39 in that primary, in a race that people are looking at as kind of an indicator of what's going on in the Democratic Party still.
Yeah, I mean, Donna Edwards really got her push from Emily's List, which is a super PAC, which was created to specifically help women, I think specifically pro-choice women, get elected. And so this was really a bit of a tension there because Van Hollen has a record of being pro-choice, of actually supporting their issues. But Emily's List argued that no, it's not just the idea of substantive representation, we also need descriptive representation. And, you know, there actually is evidence to show that descriptive representation is important. And so you had this really identity fight where substantively we're in line, but descriptively we're not. And this became this really big push where, you know, Donna Edwards was pushing identity politics, things that, and while she was able to secure a significant amount of the black vote, so was Van Hollen. So it was very clear that this tactic really didn't work, but could also be a sign of really the coalitions you see within a party where certain coalitions are trying to gain more power. It's important to understand that when you talk about parties, they're not just a group of people who all think alike. What it is a group of people who think we have similar interests. I may differ from you on these, but the few things that we do agree upon, we're there. And so a lot of times people are trying to push through certain things. You have these coalitions, and certain parts of the coalition want more power than others. And so you see these internal fights. And you see this really being played out in presidential elections, but you also see this being played out in the congressional elections as well, where certain members of Congress that are known for specific topics are going to be supported by certain groups and try to oust their others. So the idea that certain coalitions can gain more power within the party, within Congress, or even at the state level. So This is something you're going to see quite a bit, and it's important to understand the various coalitions that exist within parties and the various groups that are trying to advance their interests within the parties, with the hope being that they can advance it to the national level.
Yeah, it's really one of the things that's distinctive about the American two-party system is that the parties are not very closely or intensely defined by a narrow ideological commitment. They're coalitions of interest groups and different, very diverse interests. I think it's good. Now, one other thing that's interesting about, speaking of African-American women and identity politics, one of the stories that we couldn't fit in last week, but that is still kind of reverberating through social media a little bit as we meet this morning, is the changes to the U.S. monetary system and to who appears on the $20 bill in particular.
Yes, so it has been decided that Harriet Tubman will be on the $20 bill, but not till 2030. So Harriet Tubman, as many of you know, was part of the Underground Railroad. She was, famous for going specifically into Maryland, not really deep south, but into Maryland, and helping escape slaves. So she's referred to as the Moses of that time. And so Tubman really pointed out, because the argument was there are no women on the $20 bill. And I remember there was kind of a vote, like, who do you put forward? People said Harriet Tubman, because Harriet Tubman in many ways seemed to represent a change in terms of the nation, of recognizing people that have been forgotten in the past. And so this is somewhat interesting, again, but it's not going to take effect till 2030. Now, again, there has been some strong backlash against it. But for the most part, people are like, it is what it is. Some people think it's just being overdoing political correctness. What Ben Carson said, she should be put on a $2 bill.
Characteristically inventive Ben Carson solution.
Yeah, so my favorite was when somebody said, no, put her on the $12 bill. And then somebody immediately pointed out, like, oh, so she'd be worth 3/5 of Andrew Jackson. Who thought of that before? I was like, yeah, this keeps getting nastier and nastier. But this is one of the major changes we're seeing in terms of, who we're identifying as our American heroes.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought was worth noticing is that while there was backlash from some of the usual corners, and you had things like Ben Carsonisms with people coming up with odd ways to try to not be outright opposed to it but not really get in the spirit of the thing, for the most part, this and the other changes, they're going to put some of the suffragettes on other denominations, some of them on the back of the bill. For the most part, I thought this went over reasonably well. There wasn't too much, vituperative response. And there was some funny stuff. So, on one blog post, we had somebody, go with a much more action-oriented Harriet Tubman, which, I thought was pretty funny. In the way that these things go, this was done by somebody of fairly leftist persuasion on kind of an obscure blog. I came across it being retweeted by somebody who's well-known in Texas for being an advocate of open carry. So that was kind of their way of splitting the difference.
Well, the knock has been that they went and put an evangelical gun-toting woman on the $20 bill, which is true.
At some level, what's not to like?
Yeah.
Okay, so given that pop culture connection, we also saw a couple of funny things in the last week that had to do with the augmentation of the power of the president.
Yes, today I want to talk about something I find very near and dear to my heart. And while I've tried to deny it for some time, I must agree with my Republican colleagues that Obama's been abusing his power to a great deal. Some of you may be aware of the fact that, I want to say about a year and a half ago, that he used the power of the presidency to bring in Prince for a 2-hour concert in which Stevie Wonder also performed. If you don't
private
know.
Private party.
Private party. That's extremely important. I was not invited. Now, if I was invited, I would, again, not be against it, but I was not invited. And so the fact that President Obama personally went out of his way to restrict my ability to see Prince live is problematic. Prince had a 2-hour set. He also brought Stevie Wonder up there. If you don't know who Stevie Wonder is, again, my biggest advice, get a black friend. He'll tell you all about that, or she'll tell you all about that. And again, I'm not just saying we only need black friends. We also need white friends, because, you know, I have white friends. Because
are some of your best friends white?
Yes. I need somebody to talk to the police. All right. But the key thing about it, though, is not only did he abuse his power there, but it has also come out that he now has an advanced copy of Game of Thrones. So the story is that President Obama has the entire season. All right, so he's sitting there in the Oval Office, eating popcorn, like, ooh, I know what happened to Jon Snow. To me, this is an atrocity, all right? Now, again, if he calls me and says, hey, Eric, you want to sit there and watch the whole season with me? I'm all for it. I'll quit my complaining. So really, my complaint against President Obama really isn't so much that he has these things, but he's not shared them with me. So again, this is all about me. I'll be very open about that. Unlike other politicians who are like, no, this is principled. No. This is all personal. I wanted to see Prince. I want to see Stevie Wonder. I want to watch Game of Thrones. But, you know, again, he is sitting on the Iron Throne, abusing his power as president.
It's essentially the return of the imperial presidency. Puts yes. a new spin on it.
Really. Very, very much so.
One other story we wanted to flag a little bit before we sign off. There was an interesting development that intersected Texas and presidential politics earlier this week. So the two U.S. senators from Texas are John Cornyn, who's a longtime incumbent, first elected in 2002, had been the attorney general of Texas, very much a kind of rising, you know, insider from the days of the rise of the Republican Party to dominance in Texas. And of course, Ted Cruz, now surprisingly successful in many people's eyes in the presidential contest. Now, when Cruz got elected to the Senate, he was elected very much as an outsider, as a Tea Party candidate, somebody who was very critical of how business as usual, quote unquote, was conducted in Congress. So he went to the Senate and frankly immediately earned the dislike of his colleagues in a number of ways through both personality, political approach, and things he did substantively and procedurally. So there's always been a lot of tension between he and Senator Cornyn. Cornyn is a kind of a consummate insider now. He's a member of the Senate leadership, high-ranking member in part because he's been there so long, in part because he's worked effectively to become a member of the leadership, particularly once the other senator from Texas retired, Kay Bailey Hutchison. Cruz has been mostly implicitly, but sometimes explicitly critical of Cornyn. Cornyn, for the most part, has held his tongue, kept his head low, not wanted to rouse the ire of the Republican base that is so supportive of Cruz, but also he's in there, he's doing his job. You get the sense he understands. There's an outsider, an insider, good cop, bad cop, and he's kind of played along. Well, earlier this week, there was a noticeable change, particularly given how prominent Cruz is. Cornyn was given an interview with somebody, and they asked him about the difference in styles between Cornyn and Cruz. Now, he could have very much said, well, you could have fudged it, we're different guys. We came of age at different times politically. We have different interests, et cetera. Instead, he basically said, well, the difference is Ted Cruz came to Washington because he wanted to run for president. It's a pretty big diss on your own colleague. And again, echoed through the press, not a huge story of policy import, but pretty telling that Cornyn has kind of had it and that there are limits to the degree to which he will follow party loyalty and support Cruz.
Yeah, and this is, you know, we could say shade thrown or all kinds of other things, but it's one of the things that's part of this narrative about Ted Cruz where he's not liked by his colleagues. And, you know, I think, you know, this is problematic in many ways because while he's working to become president, and he is appealing to a large portion of the public, you're seeing a large number of elites basically say, look, this guy is horrible to work with, which raises questions about what happens if he actually is elected, or if he isn't elected, what happens when he goes back to the Senate? Is he just basically going to be that, you know, the crotchety old guy, you know, in the Senate who just complains about everything? So I guess the Bernie Sanders of the right, I don't know. But the idea is, this is problematic. I don't think Ted Cruz is as bad as we paint him to be. But the problem is, once people kind of get hooked on this one story about Ted Cruz, they're not going to let it go. And so would be interesting to see what he does to heal the relationships. Because again, it's starting to look more like, it's starting to look less like the Senate, more like an episode of Love and Basketball.
Well, you know, that also connects in a good way with our earlier discussion of parties and coalitions. In many ways, Cornyn has always been much closer to the business interest in the party, less close to the kind of grassroots, more ideologically conservative groups that have really embraced Cruz. So it is another glimpse, not just about the personality difference, but also, I mean, that's clearly there in the style difference, but also this coalitional politics that are really very pronounced in the Republican Party right now. So there's a bit of self-interest in that. On the note of self-interest, before we go, I also want to remind people that if you've enjoyed this online course, you like the online experience, you should think about summer school, you're thinking about summer school, you should think about the online courses that the College of Liberal Arts is going to offer. We're going to have several online courses formatted particularly for summer. So they'll be similar to this class in that they'll have roughly weekly deadlines. You can do the work at your own pace, but not fall behind. And if you're taking 310 now, which you obviously are, you can also find two 312s, one on foreign policy, taught by Professors Moser and McDonald, a good class. Also, a drill down into Texas government and politics that I produced most of the stuff for, but there's lots of guest videos, so you don't have to look at me the whole time. Interviews with players in the political system, lots of interesting interactive stuff, much more of a kind of insider's view of Texas government and politics. And since you have the Texas politics text that you paid for in this class, we use that text with some additional stuff, but your purchase of that text will also carry over into the summer. So we'll be offering those courses both first and last and second session. There's lots of other courses, eco, classics, history, some of which carry flags. So have a look, you'll find them on the liberal arts page or on a page in liberal arts, or you'll find them listed at the registrar. So, you know, have at it.
Yeah. So I'm going to wrap this up. Oh, I guess one, I want to say.
Oh, give us more than yet. Give us a, yeah, these classes are really great.
Oh, no, first of all, these classes are really great. These are one of the greatest things I've ever seen. You know, I weep at how pitiful I am compared to them.
You and Shaw will be doing the 310 as well.
We'll be doing the 310.
So if you like this, tell your friends.
So we'll have a 310 carrying over for the summer for both summer sessions. So if you like this class, tell your friends that we're doing it. And so, you know, we'd love to see you over the summer.
And you don't have to be in Austin to take them. They're completely online. So even the testing will be online with some fancy proctoring to help support academic honesty.
That's right. Academic honesty is what we're all about.
Right. So give it a look.
Yeah, this ain't UCLA. but I wanted to send a congratulations to Ms. Caitlin Jones, who won the 2016 Miss Quintessential, and to also thank the brothers of Eta Theta Chapter of Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated for putting on a wonderful Miss Quintessential pageant. But just in case you get confused, even though I was surrounded by purple and gold, I looked beautiful, just fabulous in my black and old gold. Again, if you don't know what that means, get a black friend. But that's all we have for this week. You all have a good week and see you next week.
And so long, Prince.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Jim Henson and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.